Okay, we're going to start 1 minute early because we're going to cover 3.5 chapters of text this morning. So I'm going to reserve that right to... Yes, I do. And I'm going to pray. Thank you, Tom. Let's go ahead and pray and then we'll jump into our text. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for being a God of wrath and a God of grace. Thank you for all that flows from history and how it instructs us. God, we pray, as the psalmist says, that your works are worth studying, that they create delight in your people. God, I pray that that would be the case, even as we look at something as sobering as the flood this morning, that you would be glorified and honored, and that we'd see you more clearly as a result of interacting with your word and interacting with one another. So would you lead us in that, God? We need your help. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. We have a lot of ground to cover. So a word of warning to the flood enthusiasts amongst us. It's going to be challenging, but the reason we're going to do what we're doing this morning isn't just that we've kind of been behind and now we're catching up, but we've seen that the literary structure of the book is intentional, and it matters, and that's kind of what's been guiding how we've been approaching these classes. So, just a quick reminder at some of the structure, and then we'll see if anyone had dug in a little bit this week before we jump in. But remember, this section of Genesis is organized, or Genesis is really organized by these toledots, these... lists or these structural markers. And so from 1:1 to 2:3, we had the creation. From chapter 2, verse 4, to the end of chapter 4, we had the toledot of the heavens and the earth, I think is what it's called. We have from 5:1 to 6:8, the toledot of Adam. We looked at that kind of in one chunk last week. And now we have the toledot of Noah, starting in 6:9, which really goes through, I think, the end of chapter 9. You'll see there's kind of a similar patterning at the end of this section that reminds us of what we saw in the generations section in chapter 5. And then we see a clear break in 10:1. We have another, these are the generations of, and that'll carry us to the end of the section. So that's why we're taking this as one big chunk, is because this is a literary unit. Okay, so it's not to avoid flood questions. It's because I think this is structured this way by the author. Okay, did anyone dig into the flood at all this week, or read and have insights or questions or things that surfaced from your reading and doing that? Even just things you noticed that were different. Will?
It's interesting. The story starts out with quite a bit of narration from God. I mean, what God is saying.
Mm-hmm.
He says all these things, and then all those things happen just like he said.
Mm.
So, something to remember. It kind of feels like, didn't I just read that? Oh, well, that's what God was saying was going to happen, and then this is it happening.
Yeah. Okay, so there's some repetition that shows his follow-through. Yeah, good. David, and then we'll come over here.
The thing that has struck me several times reading is the degree to which the flood changed the earth.
Hmm.
It's less benign. It has weather, which it didn't have beforehand. The earth has been broken in places and rent. And the volcanoes that let up the water to be the mantle of whatever they call a canopy of water that protected the earth and mankind is all over there. And as a result, we have weather. There's a hydrological cycle that wasn't present before.
Okay, so maybe some impacts on the earth. Okay, and we'll see some of those impacts in the text in terms of how things are a little bit different with creation 2.0, you could say, in our passage. Matthew or Tom, anything you guys notice out of that? No? Tom.
So, I noticed a verb. Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. I always thought that maybe God just kind of honed in on Noah, but it's a verb. Mm. Noah found favor, and so there was a kind of active participant in Noah.
Okay.
Defining favor in the eyes of the Lord.
Okay. So Noah's relationship with God, and we're gonna. Yeah, the text definitely portrays him in a positive way, at least up until the part that we're going to stop at. And then there's kind of the rounding out of the character of Noah that we'll see. But yeah, we definitely see that in our passage too. Well, good. I'm glad you guys were digging in a little bit. That's good. I think that will help us too as we navigate what's going on here.
There's one more thing that it was the clean and the not clean that went into the ark. It wasn't just the clean ones.
Okay.
Clean air and not clean animals.
Yeah, and there was maybe some differences as to why. Mm-hmm.
Does anyone think it's strange why at age 600 you only have 3 sons? I have 4 kids in 10 years.
It's wasting a bunch of time. Yeah. I don't know. I've never actually thought of that. We're also kind of bound to what the text is revealing, so that's another caveat. Did he have more? I don't know.
Only ones who were righteous, and he had other children. That's one of the reasons he was preaching, because his own kids that he had before were part of the corrupt world.
Yeah, well, when the scene happens in chapter 9, there's some question around the kids, and we'll look at that next time, but raises questions like it has every week, right? We're getting familiar with that. You're getting comfortable with not having every answer you need out of these texts. All right, well, let's jump into what it does say, and then we'll see how far we get here. The structure of, like I said, I think we're at 6:9 through 9:29. We don't have time to actually cover that whole thing. We're going to try to cover the flood and then the covenant itself. I think we're going to have to race through the flood portion, because I think the covenant portion, if we have to spend our time somewhere, that's where we're going to spend a majority of it. So that's what we'll be doing today. So the flood from 6:9 through the end of 8, and then the covenant in 9:1 through 17. So there's an introduction to this section, and right after the introduction, we get into what many think is a chiasm, okay, or chiasmus, or however you want to say it. And a chiasm, different, or a chiastic structure. And again, this is, I think it helps in scenarios like this, where what that means is you have an intentional patterning of the text so that it follows kind of something like this, where the first and the last portion line up, or they relate, then the second and the second to last portion. And the purpose of this structure is to, one, show intentionality on the part of the author, but it also kind of points to the importance of the middle point of that chiasm. Is the writer is drawing attention to that. They're trying to emphasize that. That's what this whole structure is really doing, okay? So we'll kind of unfold this. That's why as you look at your worksheets and think, what are all these letters all about? That's partly why, because I think this text is actually organized to draw attention to something specific in this chiasm. So before we get into that, we have 6, 9, and 10, which introduces the section. It says, "These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his generation. Noah walked with God." That's a phrase we've heard before, right? "And Noah had 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth." So we're introduced to this person, Noah. We just know from before, we know what his Lamech had said about him, that he would provide rest in some way. We know in verse 9 that he found favor in the eyes of the Lord. But now we're actually getting at the character of Noah that we find illustrated through the text in different ways. So, for example, in 6:22, Noah did this. He did all that God commanded him in terms of constructing the ark. And over again, we find this. 7:1, "Then the Lord said to Noah, 'Go into the ark, you and all your household, for I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation.'" So the text itself is trying to back up this idea that Noah is righteous by showing how all the ways that Noah obeys. You'll find more in 7:5 and 7:9. He builds an altar in 8:20. So the point is that God's favor has both created and it also involves obedience. We'll see that. That's how Noah is set apart, especially from the context that we came from. Okay? Now, the words in this structure that are on your sheet, I want to give credit to Alan Ross, who is a commentator, who these are his words, okay, just so you know. I thought it was the most compelling explanation of the chiasm. People disagreed about what this was and what this was and how it specifically breaks down, but just so you know, that's where that came from, okay? So the first section here in A, we see in 11 through 13, and this is going to sound familiar. Would someone read 6, 11 through 13 for us?
Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Then God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them. And behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth."
Okay, so this reminds us of a little bit of last week, right, that we saw. What are ways it reminds us of last week and what we looked at with the corruption of humanity? What do you guys see there?
Last week was Cain and Abel, right?
No, last week was chapter 5, the generations, and then with the sons of God and the daughters of man and that whole scene. So we kind of have a retelling, really, of what we saw in the corruption, right? The preamble to this was kind of setting up, why would God do something so drastic? We see why in 6, 1 through 8, and now this is just confirmation of that. And God is letting Noah understand that as well. And that I have determined to make an end of all flesh. And this is the judgment that is going to be fulfilled. So God resolves to destroy the corrupt human race. This isn't new, but this is important because it's going to be paralleled with the end where God vows to not do that again and to never do that again. Okay, so that's part of the intentionality there. Look at 14 through 22. We see letter B there where Noah builds an ark according to God's instruction. We have this massive ark, 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, 45 feet high, 3 decks. This is an amazing structure that takes time to build. One of the things to make note of in 6:14 through 22 is verses 18 and 19. This is after he gives instructions for building the ark. It says, "But I will establish my covenant with you." The first time covenant in this way has really been used. Okay, this is a big term. This is a big deal. "And you shall come into the ark, you and your sons, your wife and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female." It goes on from there. But this is the first indication of a covenant. And we're going to see this is the thing that I think moves the story of God forward and explains how it is that we're not in this situation or under this constant threat, you know, every 5 years or something, right? So he builds an ark. He tells the people in C, there you'll see letter C, to enter the ark. We have 7 pairs of clean animals and birds. Anyone know why that would be important? Why distinguishing between clean and unclean animals? Thoughts there? Yeah, Matthew?
A lot of the sacrifices usually have to do with clean animals.
Okay.
And we'll see later on in the story that Noah's going to sacrifice, and they only took 2 bulls and sacrificed them.
Sayonara bull line, yeah. Yeah, so we need...
allows for the sacrifice to happen afterwards.
Okay, yeah.
The clean animals are also better food.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine that would be the point that the people would be more interested in keeping around.
Okay. Okay, yeah, for food purposes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's purpose behind that. We can see specific instructions. One thing to note, too, as we go along through this chiasm, are the numbers that are used. So in 7:4, he gives instructions and he says, "For in 7 days I will send rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living thing that I have made I will blot out from the face of the ground. And Noah did all that was commanded." And then verse 10, "And after 7 days the waters of the flood came upon the earth." So we have seven and we have seven listed there. I'm just going to kind of note these as we go. And again, this, I think, is getting at the author's intention of the chiasm that we'll see. So sorry we're moving so fast, but we want to keep... I want you to see the overall structure, okay? And then we can go back, and if there's specific questions, we can talk about that. So this is about, okay, it's time now. The threat... The judgment, this is going to happen. Noah builds the ark, he gets it ready. The Lord tells him to go inside. Then it's 7:11 through 16. We see it begins. It says, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights." What do you guys see in that description of things? We have another number to add here, which is 40. What do you see in that description? Anything to note there?
Well, we've got a very sudden event happening.
Okay.
10 days, something happening rapidly there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of water coming.
Yeah. I mean, it's very dramatic explanation of what was happening. The fountains of the great deep burst forth. And also the windows of heaven, it almost has this divine sense to it, right? This isn't just strictly a natural event. This is a divinely ordained event that's happening. Okay, so I think this is attaching it to what's the purpose of this judgment. Yeah, Will.
And throughout the Bible, those are basically the sources of water used in the Bible for where water comes from.
Yeah.
Sky,
yeah.
Comes from these fountains of the deep.
Yeah.
Language is used in the Psalms and other places too. So
yeah.
It's just in their mindset. Where does water come from? This is where it comes from. We're getting a lot of it. This must be what happened.
Yeah.
You know, so it's what we read into that in terms of miraculous, the mechanism God used.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be a little careful. We know that he sent a lot of water.
Right.
You know, through whatever means he sent it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's some figurative language there, like windows of heaven. And, you know, get translated as floodgates. That sounds a little more, I don't know. It's just a different way to translate it.
Okay.
But there's a lot of water coming.
Yeah. Also, note the year and the timing of this. I mean, there's very intentionally saying... this time, this day, which I think speaks to this being an actual thing, and they're careful to mark the time, even as you go through the narrative. It'll spend a little, I think, more than a year. You can tell me if I'm wrong on that, Will. Somewhere around that on the ark in whole. So it's pretty amazing. I mean, that's astounding, right? A year of time, essentially, throughout this whole process. So... we see this little note at the end, too, I think, which is, again, just inserting God's role in this in verse 16. "And those that entered, male and female, of all flesh, went in as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in." This personal note of God's involved, God's, again, securing, protecting his creation. And it really, you know, the vantage point is constantly going to be the tension here is, are we looking at this as God wiping everything out, or are we looking at this as God's gracious protection of his creation that he wants to continue? That dynamic, I think, we'll see throughout the whole narrative. But we see signs of God's involvement and God's grace in this throughout.
So I was in the Navy for 6 years. I learned that most of the ship is underwater. So I was thinking, well, how could that door be closed so it'd be watertight? So that kind of answers that question. If the Lord did it, the Lord closed that door so it'd be watertight.
Yeah. Well, and there are lots of logistical questions that come up with how does this work? How do you get animals? You know, I mean, so you go down that road, and I would just say there's more on that list about how this would work. And so I go back to, we have God creating the heavens and earth from nothing. Like, if you are willing to assent to that, then how the door gets sealed, how animals get on the boat, all those things, I'm comfortable with God's ability to do the lesser things in light of the greater things that we know He does. That makes it. It doesn't mean we ignore those questions. It just means, yeah, I see all kinds of ways, reasons, based on other things of God's ability to do those things. So, anyway, yeah. If we keep moving, in E, flood prevails, the mountains are covered. Look at this, 7:17 through 21. The flood continued 40 days on the earth. The waters increased and bore up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. The waters prevailed and increased greatly on the earth, and the ark floated on the face of the waters. And the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. The waters prevailed above the mountains, covering them 15 cubits deep, and all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, livestock, beasts, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all mankind. Very sobering picture. Can you imagine the stillness of creation after an act of judgment like this? It creates awe. It creates, I think, a healthy degree of fear in creation to know that this took place. I think you have some intentionality in the idea of the waters prevailing as well. Again, we have a natural explanation for what's going on, but we know that the root of this is God's judgment, and so we see the totality of this judgment exceeding even the mountains or cresting the mountains. I think that's more than just describing what's going on. I think that's showing the totality of God's judgment and the severity of it. Is this kind of conquering idea. I know, Will, you had an interesting theory on that you'd surfaced to me before. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, the language where it talks about the high mountains being covered, both at the beginning and here also, it's the same language used when God commands the Israelites to go into the promised land and to tear down all the altars on the high mountains. So it's the same description of, like, the high places. And so we know that the people were being very evil at this time. And so what they would do back in that era is they would pile up earth and they would make these, you know, these artificial mountains, these mounds, these hells, they're called in Israel. So they put their shrines and their altars and their Asherah poles and all that on top of these. And we see some of those structures. And so, you know, when you have this flood coming in, you basically have two places to flee to. You can either get on the ark, or you can go up on this little high mountain you made and wait it out in your shrine, you know, in your temple of your false god. Mm-hmm. Who's going to save you, right? Except that the waters prevail over the top of all this stuff that people have built to protect themselves or to appeal to God in this false way, and it all gets wiped out, and we see that the waters come up high enough that it's going to be over the top of the buildings, over the top of everything that they've built. And so it's a judgment on this, everything man will do to try to save himself. Mm-hmm. And we see them kind of do this again with the Tower of Babel. Mm-hmm. Build themselves a big, tall thing, and yeah, it doesn't save them. So that's another way of looking at this language about high mountains, like, mm-hmm, whether it's really the Rocky Mountains, or yeah, it's these man-made artifices to try to worship God in their own way.
Yeah. Well, I guess either way, you find the same kind of source in God's victory over evil and God's victory over wickedness. I mean, and that's what I think the text is getting at, is that sense of everything gone. And that is a severity that I think is meant to be felt by the reader. You do have, in that last verse, "and the waters prevailed on the earth 150 days. So that's something to note. So that's where you get that length of time. It wasn't just 40 days of rain, and then 7 and 7, you've got, you know, 150 days there to go. So as we keep moving in our chiastic structure, we come to what really I think is the tip of the chiasm. And this, again, isn't just my idea. This is other people's idea that I think is really grounded in the text. And we come to the center point, which is one single half of a verse. 8:1a. "But God remembered Noah and all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark." I think is kind of the, and you think, well, why is that significant? Can you guys think of other places in Scripture where it talks about God remembering things or remembering something?
Well, even with the rainbow, I mean, we often look at the rainbow and, like, we're supposed to remember that God promised, but it actually, in the wording, it's God will remember his promise when he sees the rainbow in the sky.
So, yeah.
He's remembering his promises to us.
Yeah. So that will come up later. That's a really important connection with this word, as later on in chapter 9. Yeah, David?
I don't know the native language, but it strikes me there's two ways to think of remember. One is, oh, I forgot.
Right.
Which God doesn't do. The other is memorialize. God remembers.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably means that in this case.
Mm-hmm.
God has looked at this point and memorialized it.
Okay. Yeah, and we don't have a God who forgets, right? We know that. Other places, yeah.
I don't know if I'm remembering correctly. When the Israelites were living in Egypt, and God remembered them. I don't know if it's structured or said that way. But.
Yeah, yeah. Exodus 2. "During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. The cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew." Very similar language to Genesis, right? So this isn't about, I forgot. This is about memorialize or my covenant arrangement I am going to keep and I'm going to act on. Okay, so we see this again and again. It's why he spared Lot because of his covenant with Abraham later in Genesis. It's why Rachel, he allowed Rachel to have a child. It's even why God remembers Babylon in the book of Revelation for the purpose of judgment. So it's this, I have said I'm going to interact in this way, and so then it's basically evoking that again. God is going to do that. He's going to continue to remember. It's a really big deal, I guess, is what I'm saying. The fact that this says God remembered Noah isn't like, oh, it's been 150 days. You know, it's, no, I have an arrangement. The covenant language has already been introduced, right? And we're going to see it come up again in chapter 9. So, one author says this, "God's remembering always implies his movement towards the object. The essence of God's remembering lies in his acting towards someone because of a previous commitment." So that's what's going on here, the covenant action, okay? So if you keep going on the rest of verse 1 through 5, we see that the flood recedes and the mountains become visible. Why note that, right? Because they weren't visible before. And so now we start going back the other direction on the chiastic structure. Okay. We also note verse 3, at the end of 150 days, the waters had abated. So now we have 150 mentioned. Okay. So, and some of this is natural, right? Floods rise and floods recede. So, and you'll find if you come across this word in biblical scholarship, people will find a chiasm anywhere. So you got to be careful. It's like, it's kind of the joke, you throw a rock and you hit a chiasm in biblical study, because you can kind of read into, you know, it's like numerology or something, numbers and significance of numbers. You can really get off the deep end. So, but here I think we really have a clear example of it. That's all to say. I think we have one here. All right, in 6 through 14, the language of the earth drying keeps coming up. It says, at the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made, sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground, but the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. He waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark, and the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a freshly plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth, and he waited another 7 days and sent forth a dove, and she did not return to him anymore. Okay, so we have this period of waiting, and these birds are involved. We have, interestingly enough, that he waited another 7 days in verse 12, and then we have kind of the climactic entrance of God into the scene in verse 13. It says, in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried from off the earth. And Noah remembered the covering of the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Again, hitting it again and again and again. Then God said to Noah, go out from the ark, you and your wife, you and your sons' wives with you. And he goes on from there. So that's kind of the disembarking. But we have the earth drying in 6 through 14, okay, which, again, corresponds to the flood beginning. If you look at the other D, he tells him to leave the ark in 15 through 19. Then God said to Noah, I already read that, 17, bring out with you every living thing that's with you of all flesh, birds and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth went out by families from the ark. What a scene that would have been, right? The the celebration of, we've been on this thing a year, and now they're finally heading out. What do you guys notice as this kind of re-embarking and leaving scene? Anything?
In the 601st year of what? Of Noah's life?
Yeah, I believe so. In the first month, 27th, I forget, someone actually did the math on it, but I think it's just over a year is what it ended up being. So yeah, it started in the 600th year of his life, right? Yeah.
I don't know, but it seems good that they have two birds. One of them doesn't find any place in their soul, but the other one doesn't come back. I think the raven's a dirty bird, so a dirty bird kind of really finds his kind of rest.
Okay. So maybe there's some significance of the birds. Some people have read into the dove and the Holy Spirit connection and some of those things. Again, maybe, you know, it's hard to know if there's something intended behind that or not. I think you do have the olive branch, right? I mean, you've got that sign of hope here. Yeah, Tom.
I'm not trying to get into the details, but we're all animals cursed because of the sin of the serpent. So is that the reason why all the animals were destroyed also in the flood?
Is that why the animals were destroyed as well?
Because you think the animals are innocent. You know,
Although at the same time, I don't know that I have a good answer for you now. It is interesting, though, that the covenant that is made in chapter 9 is explicitly with man and woman and also creation.
We see something when the Israelites are to go into the Canaan land, and purge things. There are times when they're also supposed to destroy all of the animals and everything.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, that picture of like, no, you need to wipe everything out because it's been completely polluted. Whether we want to assign something to it, like, well, a disease or whatever, but that was God's judgment, is to wipe all of that out.
Yeah.
But he's not going to do it again with the flood. You know, announce Israelite's job or other mechanisms to deal with sin.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately Christ.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there's that. You almost, the totality of the event almost seems to be the underwriting point, right? And so I think because you have animals involved in that, or you obviously, I guess God could have just destroyed human beings, but the totality of that, I think, is the point, and so I think you lose some of that with if it just being a human judgment. Yeah, David?
It does say all flesh was corrupt.
Hmm. Yeah, so do you import that into the animal kingdom or not? Yeah, I don't know. All right. Awkward Ben doesn't answer the question. Move on, right? That's what we're doing. Last 9 weeks. But
one more new wokeness is, I was looking up corrupt and remembered, and it gives two or three meanings of it. And there's a word in front, like Nephilim. Does that mean that they have three meanings? It says qual, naphtal, and hippal. Those are for the three meanings of the word.
Oh, yeah, those are different ways of rendering verbs. That can influence how the word is used. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you tell which one is in this case?
Well, on Bible Hub, you can look up a verse in Hebrew, and it'll tell you which form of each word.
Yeah.
Bible Hub is really good for that one.
And in the same way that verb tenses in the English will tell you something about, I don't think tense is kind of the right way to describe Hebrew verbs, but like an aspect will help you know what to do with the Hebrew verb or not. So it depends on how it's used. Anyway, yeah. So let's keep moving. Things to note there in 15 through 19, we have language of, where is it? Be fruitful and multiply on the earth in verse 17. This is exciting. Like, this is familiar, right? We've been here before. This is a kind of a reset, and we'll see that a little bit as well. But that's important to note that we have the similar command, similar instructions. Verse 20 in chapter 8, we have, this is probably the weakest point of Ross's chiasm, I would say, is that Noah builds an ark in the same way, or builds an altar in the same way that he builds an ark, and that's kind of the corresponding point. I'd go, I'd want a little more there. But anyway, it is significant because he builds this altar, and in verse 21, and when the Lord smelled of the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever again strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So, we see the response to this sacrifice, and notice that it says, in his heart, is what this is said. Then we're going to find in chapter 9, there's dialogue with Noah. But this is the Lord's intention, will never again curse the ground. This is, I think, a really revealing section, because it shows that there's now earthly security. And yet, if you look, it's interesting. It says, I will never again curse the ground because of man, for the intention of man's heart is evil from his youth. You think, wait a minute. We just did that, right? I mean, so I think there's this acknowledgement that it's not like humanity's spiritual condition has changed, right? Now what changes things is God's covenant promise, is God's word is what's going to change the environment moving forward, not it doesn't warrant it from the sin of mankind's state. I think that's significant because it's, and we'll see that in what's come with Noah, with the Tower of Babel. And we see these rhythms that seasons will continue, that there will be just, until he returns, this will continue on. Anything else of note there you guys want to, before we jump into the covenant with Noah in chapter 9, either from these final verses, which are really significant, they kind of tie up, they finish out, you know, we started with everything's corrupt, everything's going to be wiped out, to now the Lord is going to preserve and protect his creation. Anything, comments or thoughts on?
Well, it says while the earth remains, isn't everything going to be burned up and destroyed at the end?
Mm, and I would say renewed, yeah, or replaced or remade, depending on how you view that.
This is while the earth remains. So while it's here, and then when it gets blown up, those things will be gone.
Yeah, I mean, blown up sounds a little dramatic. You know, depends on how you take that. But yeah, I think there's going to be a steadiness to creation that's the point, that we can rely on that. There's another thought or question or thing before we move on to chapter 9. Yeah?
I was always struck by when the Bible includes something that God says in his heart. Mm. Like, at what point did that enter the story? And maybe it's because he didn't know I had that heart to heart. And like, I know what my best friend's thinking sometimes. So, like, it means that Noah and God are our buddies. Noah would have known, like, oh, yeah. And then
Oh,
that was the sign that at that point.
Yeah.
God's heart was.
Yeah, like how do we have access to that revelation or to that piece
God
of information?
Knows it's in our heart. It's like saying the next over, oh yeah, many people.
Yeah.
The whole time. So like, I think it shows a kind of depth of relationship that is possible.
Mm.
He obviously has access to it.
Yeah, well, and we know that he bothers to reveal the fact that this was in his heart. Because again, we have this tension of the way the world reacts to the flood narrative is, how dare God? He doesn't value life. He doesn't, you know, he's being cruel. He's being, and yet all throughout this narrative, even if the center point of this is, but God remembered Noah, you know, then what's that about? What's that trying to emphasize? God's grace, God's provision, God's protection, right? And we have him, you know, shutting him in, and we have him revealing his heart, and we have him say the good intentions that he had in the beginning in the Garden of Eden, be fruitful and multiply, providing everything. We see that reset again. It's not a slap on the wrist saying, okay, guys, this time, seriously, do it. You know, like, it's still this gracious, good willingness to be generous to man. David and then Will.
It's also God maintaining the seed that he promised within Satan.
Correct. Very, yeah, that's great, David. You're right. That's a hugely significant. And you think, well, what happened to that promise, right? If everything is wiped out and started over. Yeah, Will.
Yeah, I was just, you know, noting how it is wonderful to have God's testimony here that he's not going to curse the ground on account of man's sin, even though we still deserve it. And this promise about this stability. I mean, even though we see that crops do fail, there are times where the, you know, harvest is not good, but we see that God is providing a sustaining overall, and although he does send locusts and stuff like that later in judgment, he's still sustaining us on this planet in a very benevolent, way more benevolent way than we deserve.
Yeah.
You know, throughout this time. And there will be local floods, and there will be things that happen, but God is still watching over us.
Yeah. And that, I think that protection, that security, provides verbiage for revealing what he's like later. So in Jeremiah 31, for example, it says, "Thus says the Lord," this is verse 35, "who gives the sun for light by day, and the fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. If this fixed order departs from before me, declares the Lord, then shall the offspring of Israel cease from being a nation before me forever." Meaning, like, it's as reliable as creation, my faithfulness to my people. And here we have the basis for knowing that the earth is going to be reliable in that way, so that God can say and compare his faithfulness to the sun comes up every morning, you know, and that kind of, it's a really brilliant move, you know, if you're trying to reveal what you're like. Yeah, Kurt, and then we need to move on.
The earth is still cursed.
Mm-hmm.
The curse of God that we leave. We still have thorns and thistles.
Yep, correct. So you have this generosity, you have this reset, and yet there's still something off that needs redeeming, and that's where that seed obviously comes in. Okay, so.
Reminds me of when Jesus on the cross, when he said, "It is finished."
Mm.
You know, I mean, it seems like God's wrath was satisfied temporarily. And then when Jesus died on the cross, it's finished.
Okay, yeah, there's that. When those waters rise above the mountains and there's silence, you know, you have a different kind of it is finished, right? You've got a wrathful type of finish. But I think there is a connection there that we'll bring up in the end. Okay, let's get to the covenant, and we'll kind of, again, have to race through that. But I want to make sure we get to implications and understand why does Noah's covenant matter moving forward. So let's look at 1 through 7. This is primarily God speaking in 1 through 17. This is what he says. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And for your lifeblood I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man. For from his fellow man I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. And you, be fruitful and multiply. Teem on the earth and multiply in it." What are some overarching things we hear? We see connections with what's come before. Things of note that are bigger picture, not smaller things about what we can eat and what we can't, but like larger things. Yeah, David.
God spoke to Abram. God spoke to Isaac. And so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes later. But here, he's talking to Noah and his sons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's repeated in verse 8. What we refer to as the Noahic covenant is actually to Noah and his sons.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
It's a covenant for all mankind.
Yeah. And that's who does it apply to? I mean, this is everybody, right? People who hate God and die hating God. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one-sided. It's not conditional. If you do this, then the earth will be fine. It's going to be this way. What's some language that we hear repeated, or some ideas we hear repeated from back earlier in Genesis? Yeah.
Well, we see that God made man in his image, and that we're to be fruitful and multiply. There's a blessing.
Yeah.
There's a blessing there, and a conference of a position or role that he has.
Mm-hmm.
To be his image.
Yeah.
The image bearers on earth. So it's still got a purpose.
Yeah, that's still the plan,
still
right?
The plan.
Okay. So what is different then? Or what are some things that are added through these verses that we see? What's that? Okay, so meat's on the table?
Yeah.
Pun intended? Okay, so.
I'm not sure what to make of all that.
Yeah, but not blood. So again, we think of the law that's coming of not eating, raw meat or blood, life being in the blood kind of idea. There still needs to be some respect there or distinction there for the use of meat. Okay, other things? Yeah?
It introduces kind of the idea that the lifeblood will require a reckoning. Like that's going to go away from the gospel.
Yeah, okay. So tell me about that. What do you mean?
I mean, he's kind of asserting, I guess, humanity's value to him and that we're in his image.
Yeah.
But also that we're corrupt and we harm each other. And kind of, he's setting up the idea that I will require something for the way we harm his image and ourselves.
Yeah.
That's what we need.
Yeah.
Reckoning.
Yeah, that loving accountability and restraint that's going to be enforced on a societal level, it would seem, right? A lot of people think this is the grounds for authority given to things like government structures and things, because God does seem to be ordaining this reckoning idea or this recompense, yeah, that's going to be required. That's new in terms of being explicit about it. And again, that's God's value of life. That's God as creator valuing things. That's a significant difference, I would say. Yeah, well.
So that statement, like what you're saying, I will require the life of man. So this is the, you know, a man has to die to pay for the sin.
Yeah.
So maybe that too is pointing towards Christ and his sacrificial death. Like this is going to be necessary at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, so sin, specifically the sin of murder, demands a payment. Even from the lives of an animal, you notice, note too, that that's, again, this is about the protection of life, a familiar blessing we've seen in the past. Yeah, so we see the plan hasn't changed. We see God's generosity. We see similar things like that. This counters the argument that the flood is God devaluing life. We see his value of life here in this section, okay? Let's finish it off, and then we can conclude. In 8 through 17, it says, "Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, 'Behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast of the earth with you, as many as came out of the ark, it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth.' And God said, 'This is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you. For all future generations, I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth.' God said to Noah, 'This is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth.'" So we have this sign, right, of the bow, which we kind of view in a certain way as this kind of a sign of peace, which it is. Many thought it was actually a bow of war, which was a weapon that was pointed away from earth as kind of a symbol of peace, which is kind of an interesting image too, that it's not maybe what we think. It's like a weapon in the sky, God saying, "I'm not going to do this again." And we have, as Julie noted, this is a covenant that God says and acknowledges himself, that this is, he's going to remember his covenant. That harkens back to God remembered Noah in 8:1, that really significant statement. So you see the repetition, you see the, this is going to be how it's going to be. It's a fixed thing. Why does the Noahic covenant matter? Let's think about that.
It's to every living creature. So it has to do with Gentiles and Jews.
Okay. Yeah, so God, people experience God's grace every day by not being under threat of a judgment they don't know necessarily exists. That's significant. Yeah, what else? Thoughts? Yeah, David?
In one sense, it's what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, "I won't judge mankind again."
Okay. Yeah, very true. Yep, and he doesn't say, "You will be spared of all difficulty and harm in every way," you know, or that there won't be a total judgment at some point, right, or things that we'll give account for. Mm-hmm. One thing to, I think, note about this covenant is that it provides an environment for God's redemption. That's one thing that I think we often miss, is this, if this weren't the case, think about that, and our sin would warrant, I mean, you think about the ways that we are very much like Genesis 6 in our day and era, and we're not living under the threat of global disaster, right? Means that there's a context in which God is going to work to bring about all these other things, right? All the other covenants can only happen if this covenant is first established. Does that make sense? You get through, you know, halfway through the covenant with Abraham, or get into the, and things get so bad under King David, or later on in life, that then this threat comes into play. This allows for redemption to take place. And the thing that secures it is not what man does and what man doesn't do. It's just God's unilateral promise, I am not going to do this again, and that sets an environment where the gospel in this seed of the woman can come to fruition. So we miss that sometimes. We kind of read this and think, that's great. We kind of presume upon it. But if we don't have this, a lot of other things are up in the air, you know, that we kind of presume upon. Thoughts on that, Julie, and then David?
So I think of the times when God wanted to destroy all of Israel. It happened a few times. And
yeah.
And he was, you know, Moses went in and mediated and he relented and didn't destroy them. It's not like he wouldn't be, we are corrupt and we do deserve to be destroyed of his mercy that we're not destroyed.
Yeah.
But he keeps his covenant. So even if he wants to and would be right to destroy, he has these covenant promises he's made to us.
Mm-hmm.
So he is merciful and patient and
stops
himself from doing what we deserve. And then Christ is an incredible picture of his love.
Yeah. And that's the intention, right? In these texts where God changes his mind or God regrets what he's done, and you think, what's going on there? Whether it be, it kind of parallels these same things, like with Moses and God saying, I'm going to take Israel out. And Moses says, no, like blot me out of the book, right? He's trying to be an intercessor in this way. And God says, well, I'm not going to do that, but I will, you know, do what you say, because someone will be blotted out of the book, you know, eventually. And so these things, as they come up in the New Testament, are examples of God's patience and mercy. If you read 1 Peter 3 or 2 Peter 2:5, these are again not the way the world interprets these events. These are examples of God's patience and God's willingness, and God he's revealing what he's like by doing things like this. So, David,
A lot of times, quotes of the Bible will use quote unquote human logic to make it impossible. But to me, this covenant and the subsequent ones make it, by human logic, possible for Christ's death and resurrection.
Hmm.
It's a logical progression from the original covenant.
Yeah. Yeah. And you think, what could restrain the wrath of a holy God for thousands upon thousands of years of being snubbed and ignored and mistreated? Like, his own word is the only thing, right, that would restrain that. And that's what you have in these covenants, of this just God binding himself, because again, he's after revealing what he's like. He's after the seed of this woman, so he'll be glorified through Jesus. And it's really astounding when you think about what he's done to reveal what he's like, and the extremes that he takes and the actions that he takes. You end up with a very different impression of the flood than some, you know, ark painted on the wall of a children's classroom that has everything smiling and happy. But then you have the